Welcome to the Morning Glory Project, Stories of Determination. I'm your host, Betsy Graziani Fassbender. Like in nature, we see determined flowers and vines clinging to life and seeking light, so are Morning Glory people. And in this podcast, I'll interview writers, activists, artists, entrepreneurs, survivors and thrivers, and trailblazers of all kinds. These are folks that have been determined to get over, under, around, and through the obstacles that face them, or to seize the opportunities that come before them. I find these people inspiring and amazing. I know you will too. I welcome to the Morning Glory Project today a guest that I've wanted to talk with for a long time. E.B. Wexler is a licensed clinical social worker and a registered yoga teacher. She's a writer and a trained mindfulness facilitator. She's been practicing clinical social work for 29 years, working with a variety of populations, and her current role is running a program to improve outcomes in behavioral health crises when law enforcement is involved. Certainly a timely topic, talking about this in June 2020. She identifies as both highly sensitive and also as an empath who has recently started sharing publicly about living with complex PTSD from her early childhood. Her mission and her purpose in going public with this is to use both her own story and her professional experience to help her shape a new conversation about trauma in our society where it carries such a great stigma. Over the years, and especially in her work and her own trauma recovery, her passion for writing and her passion for mindfulness practices have woven together into one big practice, which she uses self-discovery, self-care, and self-healing. You can find her essays on her blog at endless-exhale.com. Welcome, E.B. Wexler. I'm so glad you're here today.
I'm glad to be here, Betsy. Thank you.
So let me ask you something general about something that you've put into your bio here. You talk about being an empath. Now, in the sci-fi version of that on Star Trek, The Next Generation, that meant a very certain thing I'm saying to all the nerdy listeners that might be on the line here. But what do you mean by an empath? What does that mean to you?
Well, now I wish that I ever watched Star Trek.
Oh, well, it's only The Next Generation. It's, Lieutenant Troy is the empath of the group. That's her gift. So you may be interested. But what do you mean by it in modern non-sci-fi lingo?
That's a great question. So a lot of people confuse being an empath with being empathetic. And so people will say, oh, yes, I'm empathetic too. Being an empath is a very distinct trait in which we are sponges for energy outside of us. So that could be emotional energy of other people. It could be other kinds of energetic things, and we're sort of like a magnet, and these things are drawn to us and we absorb them.
So it's kind of like, in the negative way, it could be positive too, of course, but in the negative way, it's kind of like being the canary in the coal mine. You know, you're picking things up perhaps sooner than other folks around you.
Very much.
Or picking up on the emotional energy in a conversation, in a room, in an environment, at an event.
Yes. I think one easy example is if I go to a funeral to support somebody and I'm not particularly grieving the person who's passed away, I will leave often feeling exhausted and sad because I'm absorbing the grief of all the people at that event.
And is that different from just being somebody who's sensitive and compassionate?
It is. Well, if you drew a Venn diagram, I think the middle part would be pretty big.
There, right?
Yeah. It is, because it's not just about emotions. It's all different kinds of energy. Hmm. And because generally, I can tell you as a therapist, generally people who are sensitive to other people's feelings or who are compassionate choose when they activate that. And as an empath, it's just always on. That's why I said it's like a magnet.
Ah, so that's the difference then, is the voluntary nature of it. You just walk around in the world with this as part of who you are, as opposed to choosing to tune in and to bring your compassion, as any compassionate person would want to, to a circumstance such as a funeral or a tragedy or a loss.
Yes, but I will say the choice we do have is what to do with that energy. So it does help me make decisions about when to activate my compassion or when to activate my problem solving.
So, well, and as a clinician, that makes a difference because to just simply sit and feel what everybody's feeling isn't necessarily always the most helpful thing. Sometimes one has to act in their safety or, you know, intervene in some way. So I can see where you kind of have to be of two minds on that. So this skill as both a sensitive person and an empath, you talk about it springing forth perhaps from what you call your complex PTSD from early childhood. And I know from talking with you, as well as from reading what you've written and published, that you feel like this is sort of a coming out process you're in a way. I'm not a hate to appropriate the words, but you're sort of revealing this trauma that you've experienced in the past and that in and of itself has brought some opportunities and some challenges to you. Can you talk a bit about childhood trauma in general and then specifically what you experienced and how that has formed who you are?
Sure. So childhood trauma, and there's been a lot of research on this. There's a very famous study that's still going on by Kaiser called the ACE study, Adverse Childhood Experiences. And so in the last few decades, there's been a big focus on trauma that occurs in childhood. Because what we see is those effects just don't necessarily abate by themselves. And they can linger indefinitely. So childhood trauma is different than trauma in adulthood because it can affect development. Because the brain is still developing, because a child is not a fully formed person who's independent, able to take care of themselves. There are a lot of other dimensions of that.
So I'm guessing then, and you tell me if this is so, the adults around a child who's experiencing the same thing that they're experiencing may experience trauma from it, but may be much more able to recover from it because they have a body of, not only are they more developed, but they have some skills and some abilities to cope or some abilities to move on, whereas the child just kind of absorbs all of it, right, and doesn't have all of that. So they could be in the same room experiencing the same thing, but the childhood trauma is different.
Absolutely.
And lasts in ways that they don't even necessarily know or understand, right?
Yes.
So you say that from age 4 to what age? From age 4 to 25, you didn't really even understand that you had experienced a trauma. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. And I actually did know about the events, which I'll just say quickly. So my basic story is that when I was just shy of 4, my mother went into labor early with my younger brother. He's my only sibling. And so he was born early. He was born with apnea, and he was born with the flu because she had the flu. And so he had to stay in the special care nursery. Now, I've actually worked in pediatric medicine as a social worker, and that what my brother experienced in 1970 would not be a big deal today.
Just because we know more medically, you mean?
Yeah, absolutely. But it was a really big deal back then, and there was a lot of concern that he might not pull through. And then my mother had some postpartum complications that led to a critical medical situation in which she almost died.
So you were a 4-year-old waiting for a new brother who came early, traumatically, and sick, and then your mom nearly dying as a result.
Yeah, after my brother came home from the hospital, then my mother went back in. Yes.
So then this was prolonged over some time. This wasn't a one-day event. This was a series of traumatic events.
Yeah, and she was in the hospital for a long time. She was very sick.
Oh, okay. So then that's another thing, which is you're 4 years old and your mom's gone.
Right.
For how long? And I'm guessing at 4 at that era, you weren't welcomed into the hospital to go visit her.
I believe I did. I've asked my parents. I don't have a lot of memory. I have memory, very clear memory from before that time. but memory about my mom's pregnancy and my brother's birth is a little bit fuzzy.
Well, and isn't that funny too? And, you know, it's like that with trauma. Some people have a trauma and they have preserved every single nuance of the memory of it because it just sticks in there. And other people, the trauma is a blur.
Yes.
It sounds, and in addition to that, that phenomenon, you were also a very little girl. So it got blurry, right?
Yes.
So you experienced this trauma. And as a result, you went on, you know, you were in a family that moved on and went on. And what ensued after that? I mean, is this something your family talked about? Is this something?
It's something I always knew. I'm not sure that we talked about it a lot at the time, but there was also another incident that only involved me within about 6 months. And that was that this is kind of ironic. My father went into the hospital for a very routine, non-urgent procedure. And my mother dropped me off at my grandmother's apartment so she could babysit for me.
And this is how long after your brother's born?
He was still an infant. I would say about 6 months or so.
Okay.
And two men broke into her apartment to rob her. And they had a gun. And I'm not sure how this happened, but this entire thing played. This I have a clear memory of, which is kind of strange. This whole thing played out in her very small galley kitchen of her apartment. She picked up the phone. I'm not sure why she thought they would wait for her to dial 911 on a rotary phone. But and they ripped the entire phone jack out of the wall. And we were just all in this tiny room. And my grandmother became kind of hysterical and was yelling and screaming. And I guess sort of ironically, these guys decided it wasn't worth it. And they left without taking anything. Hmm. I remember the gun. I remember how hysterical my grandmother was. And I remember the police coming and taking the report.
You know, as I listen to these stories, as awful as they are, they're not, other than the break-in, many of the things that you describe are not exceptional in that they're the trouble, the medical challenges that people have, things happen, but that they were all kind of bunched up and that your age was so vulnerable at the time. I bet a lot of people wouldn't think of those as trauma because everything turned out okay. You know, your brother didn't die, your mom didn't die, your grandma was safe, nothing got robbed. You know, it can be easy, I think, to brush off those things and not call them traumas. Do you find that you've had the urge to do that for yourself and that perhaps others do that too?
Oh, I still have the urge to do that. And I think it's also, I've worked with a lot of trauma survivors. It's very common, no matter what the trauma, for someone to say somebody else has it worse. There are worse situations. And I frankly, from both sides of the couch, if you will, see that as a way that we're trying to minimize the trauma because that's how we survive trauma as humans. We have to cut it up and compartmentalize it. We have to hide it from our consciousness. Or we have to minimize it.
And so some of that is, to some degree, adaptive and healthy to do. It's like, okay, let me sort this out a little bit. Nobody died. We're safe. That was hard, but we can get through this, right? I can kind of almost hear somebody talking themselves through those kinds of moments. And sometimes that's about taking the perspective of gratitude and all of that. So you're not saying don't move through such things and don't move on from them. But what you're saying, I'm hearing, I think, is, yeah, but we also have to call it what it was. It was also a traumatic thing to witness and to be part of. And it had an impact.
So when I teach about trauma, because I'm a trauma trainer also, there are three aspects to what makes something clinical that we pay attention to. And one is, what was the perception or the impact at the time? What was the context? What was the story? And for me, I think that was that I was angry and I didn't want a little sibling. Mm. And because kids under the age of 7 think everything happens because of them, I've sort of pieced together that it's probably very likely that I blamed myself.
Mm, it was your fault that your brother was sick.
And that my mom almost died. Sick. Yeah. Yeah. The second is, does it get processed or not? So PTSD is basically an unfinished, an incomplete fight or flight cycle. It's stuck. And mine did not get processed as such. And then, does it persist? So do the symptoms or the effects of what the person experienced, regardless of the age, but especially in early childhood, do they persist? And I can look back now and tell you that the diagnosis of PTSD didn't even exist yet for 10 years until after my traumas, but that I had symptoms of it my whole life. It just wasn't identified, so it couldn't be treated. It couldn't. We couldn't talk through it. We couldn't detect anything because we didn't know.
You know, it makes me think, too, that there was a time when PTSD was a diagnosis almost exclusively for soldiers, for survivors of combat.
Yes.
Right? They called it combat fatigue, you know, even before there was a name for that. And shell shock, even.
Yes.
They called it.
As far back as World War II, they called it shell shock.
So it is a conversational leap and an intellectual and social science leap to then look at trauma beyond war, that trauma doesn't have to be of that ilk, that it could be a child's experience of seemingly natural but troubling events. And then also, like you said, the robbery was an intrusion and a violation. So we're generalizing that. So can you tell me then, as you grew, you say from 4 to 25, this wasn't diagnosed. So how did it evidence itself to you as an 18-year-old, as a 20-year-old? How did it evidence itself so that you knew something wasn't right?
I wouldn't say I knew something wasn't right. I just pretty much thought that there was something wrong with me. Well, I guess yes. There was something wrong with me because I would look around and other people didn't have this persistent sense of dread and vigilance that I had. How it manifested was very, very strong reactions to things, a very strong fear reaction, anxiety reactions, emotional reactions, and being highly sensitive and being an empath certainly didn't help this. I mean, it really bolstered it quite a bit. And I feel that being highly sensitive and being an empath meant the impact of the traumas hit me harder than it might have another 4-year-old.
Because you were absorbing not only your own experience, but probably the fears of the loved ones around you.
Yes.
I understand that coming out with this, saying this out in the world, is a process for you that's also been a challenge, that you've been private in a way about this. You've been sort of cloistered about talking about this trauma. And even though it's funny, because when I hear you talk about it, and I heard you talk about not disclosing this trauma before I knew what it was. And so when I hear you talk about it, I think, oh my gosh, poor baby, that happened to you. I'm so sorry. And I wonder why the secrecy, why the telling about this is such a hard thing to do. It wasn't like it was something that was your fault. Although as a little kid, egocentrically speaking, we all think that we caused everything, of course. But as an adult looking back, you don't think that. So what is it that's so hard about telling the truth about this?
I'm still figuring that out. I would say, and I may always be, I would say that because I thought it was my fault and because it was not something that got talked about, that there was no, I was 4, so I couldn't initiate a conversation about it. It got, the story that developed around it was, this needs to be a secret. And that felt more real to me than anything else until very recently.
And this needs to be a secret. Do you think that came from your family? Just like, it's too upsetting, we don't talk about these things? Or
I actually don't. So let me add a little detail in here, which is I had about a year later, because we now know with all this research, I had classic symptoms of childhood trauma.
Which were what? How would somebody see that in a
child? And they take 12 to 18 months to show up, research shows. Which were things like, let's see, I would roll my fingers like I had something in my hand, reach down to touch the ground while I was walking, make sort of noises with my mouth. I had panic attacks. These, like, almost what you would see with, like, extreme anxiety, like a kid with Tourette's.
Or like obsessive compulsive kinds of behavior.
Yes. So my parents called the pediatrician and took me to a child psychiatrist one time, which I remember, by the way. And I didn't figure that out until I was an adult either and happened to come up in conversation. And after they took me for one appointment, all of that disappeared. Like that day.
Like instant cure? But not.
But not because if I wish I could go back and interview my 6-year-old self. But I think probably what happened was that story that it was my fault, that story that something was really wrong with me got bolstered, and that I felt the most adaptive thing to do was to continue to hide that and to hide it even deeper.
You know, it's funny because I too am a therapist. And so we always think of, well, go to therapy. That's a great thing. And it can be, and it is, and I'm in the profession, you are too, for good reason, because we believe in talking things out. But it seems like as a little kid, your experience of it was, oh my gosh, this whole problem's getting amplified. I must be a problem. Let's make it go away for them. Right? Like you tucked everything away.
Yes. And I'm not saying that everybody would respond the same way. And I've had a lot of friends who've had their young children exposed to traumatic events talk to me about this because of my experience. And really, there was no template then because the diagnosis didn't exist. No one would have applied it to a suburban kindergartner. As you pointed out, it was only, even 10 years later, it was only applied to veterans for a very long time. And so it was just sort of grasping in the dark. And when things got better, that looked good. And my parents truly felt like I felt like they were on it.
Well, and they were. They brought you in for help, right? They
weren't that makes evil sense. People. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it makes me think of something. Before I became a therapist, I was a teacher for a short time, and there was a little boy in my class. I'll never forget him. His name was Darren, and Darren was supposed to get his tonsils out. So he was 6 and a half, 7, and this kid was freaked. I mean, he was beyond freaked out about getting his tonsils out, so much so that his mother just came to me and said, is there something you can help me with at school? Because we're afraid we're going to have to sedate him at home because he will be a screaming mess to even take him to a hospital. And they just didn't want to traumatize him like that. And, you know, so we did a field trip to the hospital. We did a bunch of things to try to help Darren through this that we tried to weave into the curriculum, right? Back at a time when teachers got to do such things. And finally, one day, Darren was sitting on the curb waiting for the bus. And I sat down beside him and I said, you know, honey, what is so scary? And it turns out that Darren thought that in order to take his tonsils out, that they had to take his head off.
Oh my goodness.
So the whole thing, he wasn't freaked about getting his tonsils out. He was freaked about them cutting his head off. Now I'm thinking about you as a kid, just a little bit younger than he was at the time, and thinking how your little psyche twisted that into something you could understand, or what you didn't understand about it, how you made it your fault, how, you know, where you tucked it, how you processed that. When we're with little kids, it's just it's a whole different world in their little minds.
Yeah, for sure.
So at 25, you kind of understand this better. You get a diagnosis for this. You're drawn to a helping profession, and you currently help people, particularly after law enforcement events. Certainly the events of the spring and summer of 2020 have got to be climbing all over your world in a very special way, that as it is for all of us, but you especially because of what you do. How are you growing through this, and how does one get through this? And if you could talk to yourself at 16, 17, 18, 20, 25, what might you say to help yourself through?
Let me first just fill in that I got diagnosed about a year after I began working in my field, and it was because of a triggering event. So I was mugged, which wasn't fun, but it wasn't awful. But I had such an off the charts reaction that my therapist went digging around. And I thank the universe every day for that.
Well, so let me flag that before we go on.
Sure.
That's another indicator that people can know that it's more than just the event. If your response to something is so disproportionate to the event, it's not that you're extra crazy. It's that it's triggering something else.
Right.
So you got diagnosed and?
I got diagnosed, and having the diagnosis and getting treatment for something that had 20 some years to marinate and settle into my bones has been a lifelong process. I kind of liken it to dismantling a bomb, because my defenses were so well developed that going into and activating any of them would shut down the healing process temporarily. So it was like a 2 steps forward, 1 step back, 1 step forward, 8 steps back. It was very touch and go for a long time. How I have used it to help other people. What's really interesting is that I chose a profession where we're not supposed to talk about our own stuff, especially 30 years ago. So it's really true, and I don't do direct service anymore, but it's really true, and you know this, in the therapy room, that you don't say to your client, oh my God, let me tell you about my stuff, right? And so that reinforced throughout my adulthood that this needed to be kept close to the vest.
So here you were in a helping profession that was helping others, but that was maybe putting your own trauma further down under. How did you begin, in addition to the therapy? I know, because you're a certified registered yoga teacher, that yoga is part of what you do. What are the things that you do or have done that have helped you get through?
Yoga is not only something that helps me get through, but it is part of how I am unpacking all of this. Because trauma gets stored in the body, so we cannot heal trauma solely with therapy, at least talk therapy. What actually was a big turning point for me, gosh, almost 20 years ago, maybe 17 years ago, was that I started a regular meditation practice. And a regular meditation practice is designed to sort of melt the outer layers of our armor. And when you do that, whatever's under there is what you encounter. And so after about a year of dedicated meditation practice, I found myself very symptomatic with my PTSD.
So it gets worse before it gets better. It got worse before it got better.
It does, and it cycles. That's what I was saying about 2 steps forward, 1 step back. It often cycles that way.
And don't you think that the nature of trauma also is people look at it and think, oh my gosh, this happened so long ago. Just snap out of it, for Pete's sake. Move on. Get over it. I think there's an impatience with folks sometimes when they look at trauma. People, they think that they're being, I don't know, melodramatic or sympathy seeking or something.
Oh, I don't think that. I know it. And not just from my own experience, but from having treated hundreds of people with trauma. Absolutely.
but it lives. So even if somebody is, and you know, it wasn't like you were laying on a couch all day and doing nothing. You were working and doing, you know, functioning as a human being and getting around and having friends and doing the things that normal people, you know, regular people do in regular life. So it wasn't like you weren't accomplishing anything, but this subterranean thing was still happening and making your existence more challenging.
Yes. And what's interesting is that only as I have embarked on the process of starting to speak publicly about it, have I realized that my main goal in life and my survival felt like it depended on this, was to keep that mask on, was to make sure nobody could see. So I worked with people who have said to me, I can't imagine you ever getting upset, because I project this sort of calm, problem solving. I'm the healer. I'm the soother. I'm the person. I'm the teacher. And I'm very, very calm. And I always laughed when they said that, because if they had an emotional x-ray machine, they would have found a tsunami inside of me.
Well, you and I may have some common ground there. I've often had people say, oh, I wonder what you're like when you're really angry. And I thought, well, I was.
Oh, yeah. And people say to me, not just, I wonder what you're like, but I can't imagine you ever getting upset.
So this is about looking under the outer coat of how we walk around in the world. And I know that your concept, can you just tell me, as we come to a close here, tell me about why you've chosen Endless Exhale as both your website and, I'm taking it, a philosophy. What does that mean?
It was actually kind of impulsive, but it is certainly a philosophy now that you say that. I had a treatment a number of years ago, a first treatment with a total stranger who practiced something called Lomi, which is widely thought of as a Hawaiian massage technique, but it's much more than that. And I was in a very sort of deep valley of trauma recovery at that time. And I'd also had a very, very persistent, annoying, dry cough without being sick for a long time. And so on my exhale, I would cough at the end. And I got on her table face down, and she started doing the thing where they, you know, just press down on your back and moving her hands, and said, your only job is to breathe. And I would take a deep breath in, and then I would exhale, and she would push. And the only reason I inhaled was to take the next exhale. It felt like I could have exhaled forever. Hmm. Not like, you know, when you exhale, we always eventually get to the point where it's like, okay, I'm going to need to inhale.
Where it's a little ragged at the end.
Yeah,
right.
I wasn't getting to that point until I knew, okay, if I, you know, or I was following her cues. And after 3 months of not being able to really have a full exhale, I said to her, that felt like an endless exhale.
Mm. What that says to me is that's about freedom. That's about letting go. That's about not feeling the obligation to do it differently, or the interruption of, in that case, a cough, but metaphorically speaking, interruption to us just living our lives and going forward and relaxing and being and not being afraid.
Yes. The permission to take off the mask. Yes. I recently told somebody about having publicly, you know, posted things about my diagnosis. And they said, do you feel liberated? And I said, I do, but only about 5% of that is from actually talking about it. 95% of it is liberating, happened before I disclosed it, liberating me from the shame, liberating me from the persona.
And the shame is about not what happened, but I'm a mess, or there's something wrong with me because I feel this way, or I process things this way, or I'm traumatized by X or Y or Z. I should be better than that.
Yes, but I think the original shame was, look what I made happen.
Look what I made happen with my brother.
Yeah.
Which was a false thing, but built on a whole system that your psyche built up as a way of believing. Well, I'm so happy that you're choosing to talk about this, not only for yourself, but because I think that it lets other people know that they can too. And I know that your goal is to be of service. And you certainly are. E.B. Wexler, I'm so glad that you chose to share your story today with the Morning Glory Project, and I'm honored that you would share it with me. You can find out more about by going to www.endless-exhale.com and find many of this lovely woman's blog posts and stories. Blessings to you. Thank you so much for being on the Morning Glory Project.
Thank you, Betsy. It was an honor.
I'm going to tell you the truth here. My conversation with E.B. Wexler went a different way than I thought it was going to today. Isn't that fun when that happens? I originally invited her on this program because she's such an activist and because she's done incredible work as a social worker through the police department, doing education, helping them be more sensitive to issues of poverty, issues of mental illness, working with people of color, all kinds of ways that she's helped to bridge gaps. And we didn't even get to all of that, which is regretful. Perhaps she'll have to come back on another time. But where we did go makes me happy too, because what she's talking about is being both a healer and a person who has had wounds, and how, in a way, she's kept those hidden. Lots of healers, whether they're physicians or therapists or counselors of other kinds, are doing what they do because they've had something occur in their life that made them feel like they wanted to help others with similar anguish. And there's a double-edged sword there, because on one hand, that anguish makes them more empathic and more able to be sensitive to the needs of those they serve, but it also means that some of their work can be hurtful to themselves. It also can sometimes mean that they have to hide their own wounds, their own, if they're taking medication, if they've struggled with depression, if they've had their own PTSD symptoms, and they sometimes don't feel like they can tell about that. So when my guest talked about that she had permission to take off the mask and how liberating it was that she could talk about her own history, how she's made as both an empath and somebody who has had PTSD or continues to, that she was liberated 95%. I rather like that. You know, there's an expression in 12-step recovery rooms that says, "You're only as sick as your secrets." I wonder if that's true of the masks that we wear. And of course, I'm not talking about the masks that we need to wear because of COVID-19. I'm talking about the theater that we sometimes have to put on, the game face that we put on for others. It just makes you wonder how much that costs and how free we can all be if we give ourselves permission to remove our masks. That's a pretty nice extra bloom. Thanks so much for listening to the Morning Glory Project today. I hope that this has given you a little tidbit, a little nugget, a little inspiration. And I hope that wherever you are, that you find your own way to bloom.